Today is Friday, July 18th, 2025, and you are listening to the World Socialist website. The Return of the Epstein Scandal and the Criminality of the U.S. Ruling Class by Patrick Martin. The scandal over billionaire sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein and his ties to a wide range of figures in the American ruling class, including Donald Trump, has erupted into a major political crisis. Nearly 6 years after Epstein's dubious suicide in a Manhattan jail cell, the White House is being assailed by demands to release investigative files which could implicate hundreds of top political and business figures, Republicans and Democrats, bankers and CEOs. Even though more than 1,000 victims have been identified, the U.S. government has refused to name even a single one of the wealthy and well-connected men who availed themselves of Epstein's services as a procurer of underage girls for sexual exploitation. Attorney General Pam Bondi touched off a political explosion last week by releasing a two-page report declaring that no so-called client list had been found in Epstein's files, that there was no suspicion of foul play in his death, and that there would be no further information released about Epstein's crimes. This statement was issued only 3 months after Bondi appeared on Fox News, just after her confirmation by the Senate, boasting that the list of Epstein's clients was, quote, on my desk, end quote, and would soon be made public. Fascist supporters of Trump, including former White House aide Steve Bannon, Representative Lauren Boebert, and social media pundits Tucker Carlson, Alex Jones, and Laura Loomer, all denounced Bondi. They cited Trump's claims during last year's election campaign that the Democrats were covering up the Epstein case because so many prominent Democrats were implicated in it, particularly former President Bill Clinton, who reportedly rode on Epstein's private plane dubbed the Lolita Express on 27 occasions. Epstein was a financial supporter of Clinton's election campaigns and visited the White House at least 4 times during his presidency. Trump, however, fired back in defense of Bondi and declared that the Epstein files had actually been created by the Democrats, including Presidents Obama and Biden, to attack him. As is well known, Trump had a 15-year association with Epstein, a Palm Beach neighbor, fellow billionaire, and frequent guest at Mar-a-Lago. He wrote on Truth Social Wednesday morning that his former supporters had fallen for a Democratic Party plot. Quote, their new scam is what we will forever call the Jeffrey Epstein hoax, and my past supporters have bought into this bullshit, hook, line, and sinker, end quote. Trump's bizarre somersault caught some of his most slavish supporters by surprise. House Speaker Mike Johnson called for full disclosure of the Epstein files only hours before Trump's Truth Social post, then tried to downplay the conflict. The next day, he moved to block consideration of legislation introduced by the Democrats to require the Justice Department to release the files. The political crisis exploded to a new level Thursday evening with the publication by the Wall Street Journal of a lengthy front-page article detailing Trump's relationship with Epstein, which included Trump sending Epstein a letter for his 50th birthday, January 20, 2003, described as follows. Quote, the letter bearing Trump's name, which was reviewed by the journal, is bawdy, like others in the album. It contains several lines of typewritten text framed by the outline of a naked woman, which appears to be hand-drawn with a heavy marker. A small pair of arcs denote the woman's breasts, and the future president's signature is a squiggly Donald below her waist, mimicking pubic hair. The letter concludes, happy birthday, and may every day be another wonderful secret. End quote. Trump claimed Tuesday in an interview with the Journal that the letter was a fake and that he would sue if the article was published. It nevertheless appeared on the Journal's website early Thursday evening with a large photo of Epstein and Trump standing together, looking like the best of friends. The article also reproduced portions of a profile of the Trump-Epstein relationship published by New York Magazine in 2002, in which Trump indicates familiarity with Epstein's sexual practices. Quote, Trump told the magazine, quote, he's a lot of fun to be with. It is even said that he likes beautiful women as much as I do, and many of them are on the younger side. No doubt about it, Jeffrey enjoys his social life, end quote. The intervention of the Journal indicates that the very real criminality involved in the Epstein scandal, involving significant sections of the political and financial establishment, is intersecting with divisions within the ruling class itself. The newspaper is owned by media mogul Rupert Murdoch, who has long backed Trump as a spearhead for imposing reactionary pro-corporate policies, and which has fully supported his attacks on democratic rights and social programs. The Journal has been highly critical, however, of Trump's economic policies, particularly the tariff war he began in April and his threats to remove Federal Reserve Board Chairman Jerome Powell. Last week, Trump set an August 1 deadline for the imposition of massive tariffs on dozens of U.S. trading partners, which would raise prices dramatically and slash global trade. The Journal has been highly critical, however, of Trump's economic policies, particularly the tariff war he began in April and his threats to remove Federal Reserve Board Chairman Jerome Powell. Last week, Trump set an August 1 deadline for the imposition of massive tariffs on dozens of U.S. trading partners, which would raise prices dramatically and slash global trade. The basic outline of the Epstein scandal is well established. From humble beginnings in Brooklyn, Epstein found wealthy patrons, first the CEO of Bear Stearns, Andrew Greenberg, and then the founder-owner of The Limited, Leslie Wexner, who valued his combination of skill, moral depravity, and ruthlessness in the early years of the financialization of the U.S. economy. Epstein became known as a man who could make money from cleverly crafted swindling, first as a securities trader, then as the personal financial manager for Wexner's billion-dollar fortune. Epstein built his own fortune in the process, ultimately buying the largest mansion in Manhattan, sold to him by Wexner, as well as a Palm Beach estate, a huge ranch in New Mexico, and a private island in the U.S. Virgin Islands. He hosted parties that attracted billionaires, bankers, CEOs, former presidents, senators, and governors. His connections extended through both capitalist parties, Republicans as well as Democrats. In gaining access to these layers, he also learned their sordid proclivities, particularly those which coincided with his own, the sexual abuse of underage girls. His literal partner in crime, Ghislaine Maxwell, daughter of British media billionaire Robert Maxwell, served as his chief recruiting officer, luring young girls, particularly from the poorest sections of the working class, with promises of money, clothes, shoes, and perfume. One victim told the Miami Herald, quote, "Jeffrey preyed on girls who were in a bad way, girls who were basically homeless. He went after girls who he thought no one would listen to, and he was right," end quote. The newspaper, which published the first major exposure of Epstein, added, quote, "Most of the girls came from disadvantaged families, single-parent homes, or foster care. Some had experienced troubles that belied their ages. They had parents and friends who committed suicide, mothers abused by husbands and boyfriends, fathers who molested and beat them," end quote. Epstein's sex trafficking enterprise served the psychosexual demands of wealthy and powerful men who in turn protected his operations and blocked any serious criminal investigation. Even in 2007, when Epstein pled guilty to soliciting the prostitution of a minor, a serious felony for which anyone else would have been locked up for years, the U.S. Attorney for South Florida, Alexander Acosta, made a backroom deal that allowed him to freely manage his business ventures from a luxury jail wing that Epstein paid for himself. The plea agreement assured that none of Epstein's clients who were not named would be prosecuted for their use of his sex trafficking services. 10 years later, Donald Trump would appoint Acosta to head the Department of Labor in his first term, a position from which he was forced to resign when Epstein was again arrested in July 2019 on sex trafficking charges. FBI reports identified more than 1,000 young women and girls as victims of Epstein. Yet not a single American client of Epstein has been named, let alone prosecuted. Only one foreign client, Britain's Prince Andrew, was compelled to sign a civil settlement with Virginia Giuffre, whom Epstein procured for him at age 17 while she was working at Mar-a-Lago. Giuffre, who named other men as abusers who were never prosecuted, committed suicide in April of this year. When Epstein was found dead in his prison cell in Manhattan in August 2019, supposedly having hanged himself while prison guards failed to check on him for hours, it was not just Donald Trump who could breathe a sigh of relief. There were hundreds of powerful figures in the U.S. ruling class who felt the same way. There was a universal desire to cover up both Epstein's sordid enterprise and the circumstances of his death. This sentiment found expression in the pages of the New York Times. The leading U.S. newspaper assiduously promoted uncorroborated and generally baseless charges of sexual abuse in the Me Too campaign, which became a means of witch-hunting actors, musicians, and other cultural figures. But in the case of Epstein, the Times now denounced quote-unquote conspiracy theories about his murder and showed no interest in tracing his clientele in the ruling class. The World Socialist website has long maintained that the Epstein case exposed the blatant corruption of the U.S. financial oligarchy and its political servants. We wrote after Epstein's death, quote, "There is a social logic to the circling of the wagons in the Epstein case. The U.S. financial oligarchy feels itself under siege. It senses the tremendous hostility that exists within the population. If millions suspect that Epstein was murdered, it is because they know instinctively that the U.S. ruling elite is fully capable of such a crime. It is not the peculiar properties of the internet and social media that account for such suspicions, but the entirely justified sentiments among millions of working people who see the criminal character of the class that controls all wealth and power in America. Every great revolution in history has been preceded by similar scandals, in which the criminal and reactionary character of the old ruling class reveals itself, and that class is exposed for what it is, a cancer on the body politic. End quote. 6 years later, the cancer on the body politic has produced the second Trump administration, which is seeking to establish a presidential dictatorship while waging war on every social right of the working class. Meanwhile, not 1% of the facts about the depraved criminal enterprise that is the Epstein scandal has yet come out. Workers have every right to demand that all the files in the Epstein case should be made public, with only the names of the victims protected, not the names of the perpetrators and accomplices. Particular attention should be given to the reports that Epstein had connections to the intelligence agencies of the U.S. or Israel, or both, and that information he gathered from his sex trafficking operation was used for the purposes of blackmail in the interests of these agencies. It is most important to recognize the connection between the rekindling of the Epstein scandal and the deeper crisis of American and world capitalism. The working class must intervene independently against the gangsterism of the Trump administration and go on the political offensive against the capitalist system, the financial oligarchy, and all its political agents. U.S. Senate votes to end funding of public broadcasting by David Walsh. The U.S. Senate voted early Thursday to withdraw financing already allocated for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, CPB, which in part funds National Public Radio, NPR, and the Public Broadcasting Service, PBS. By a vote of 51 to 48, the most august legislative political body in the U.S. cast its support for the elimination of public broadcasting, first established in 1967 under Lyndon Johnson. The majority of senators, in effect, announced their determination to do whatever lay in their power to encourage ignorance and backwardness and suppress political criticism, even of the most limited variety. The Senate vote corresponded to a White House demand to take back $9 billion for foreign aid in public broadcasting. The administration submitted a rescissions bill, a measure that cancels previously approved funding. In this manner, Congress reverses its own spending decisions. The House is expected to approve the action, sending it to Trump for his signature. The amounts involved are minuscule by American government budgetary standards. The CPB had been allocated $1.1 billion by Congress for the next 2 years to be dispersed among some 1,500 local stations nationwide. Senate Majority Leader John Thune, a Republican from South Dakota, told Fox News, quote, "I think $9 billion is a very small amount of money, as I mentioned, 0.1% of all federal spending, but we've got to look at all aspects of the federal budget and figure out where we can root out waste, fraud, and abuse to put this country on a more sustainable fiscal path. We just can't sustain where we are," end quote. Of course, this comment has no bearing on objective reality, except insofar as the latter is perceived by a representative of the U.S. ruling elite. The American government spends unimaginable sums each year on murderous weapons and equipment, spying on its own and other populations in countless illegal and bloody military CIA operations in every corner of the globe. It grudgingly hands out what amounts to pennies on culture, education, and the arts. And Congress is now resolutely trying to put a halt to that fearful so-called waste of public money. The funding of NPR and PBS is complicated and comes from a number of sources, as there has never been a significant or adequate federal government subsidy. NPR only receives a small amount, some 1% of its funding directly from the federal government. PBS receives approximately 15% of its money from the federal government. The majority of the CPB's appropriation goes to local public television and radio stations through grants. These local stations then choose to become members of PBS or NPR and pay dues and fees to the national organizations for programming and other services. According to the Public Media Alliance, approximately 60 million Americans accessed NPR content weekly across various platforms in 2020, including radio broadcasts, podcasts, and digital services. This reach is facilitated by NPR's network of member and affiliate stations, ensuring that 98.5% of the U.S. population resides within the listening area of a station carrying NPR programming. The attack on NPR and PBS is an assault on the democratic rights of the population, its right to information, emergency services, and culture. It will be particularly devastating in rural areas, where smaller broadcasters may be forced off the air over the coming months. As CNN noted, quote, "Stations in rural areas and smaller communities tend to rely more heavily on the federal subsidy. Stations in larger markets typically have a wider variety of other funding sources, like viewer donations and foundation support," end quote. In a statement, Patricia Harrison, president and CEO of the CPB, insisted that, quote, "For nearly six decades, public media has served families in every corner of America, especially rural and tribal communities, providing extraordinary vital content and services free of charge. Without federal funding, many local public radio and television stations will be forced to shut down," end quote. In May, Trump attempted to fire three members of CPB's board. The agency then sued the president, who recently sued the board members. The New York Times commented July 14 that an internal NPR report from 2011 estimated, quote, that if Congress cut off funding to the public radio system, up to 18% of the roughly 1,000 member stations would close, with broadcasters in the Midwest, South, and West affected the most. Nationwide, up to 30% of listeners would lose access to NPR programming, end quote. At work here are both an immediate political goal, the suppression of news sources that do not parrot the fascistic line of the Trump administration, and the larger principle of opposition to the existence of radio and television programming outside of the control of giant profit-making conglomerates. With Trump, there must always be the hope, too, that somehow the growth of private broadcasting at the expense of PBS and NPR will produce filthy lucre for him and his family. Attacks by the extreme right on PBS, NPR, and other bodies such as the National Endowment for the Arts have been underway for decades. Half-hearted or more determined efforts to stop their funding have been made by previous Republican administrations, including Trump's first. But as part of the broader social and cultural counter-revolution, Trump and his accomplices have made it clear that this time they intend to destroy these agencies and institutions once and for all. In April, for example, the White House announced plans to terminate financing for 85% of the National Endowment for the Humanities grants. The endowment is the largest federal government source of funding for museums, libraries, colleges and universities, historical sites, cultural research projects, and individual scholars. Instead, the NEH's acting chairman told its 24-member advisory council that the endowment, quote, would pivot to supporting the White House's agenda, end quote, and in particular, quote, would support Mr. Trump's planned patriotic sculpture garden and the broader celebration of the 250th anniversary of American independence on July 4, 2026, end quote. In early May, the White House released the president's fiscal year 2026 budget proposal, which called for the eradication of the NEA, NEH, and the Institute of Museum and Library Services. In terms of the attack on public broadcasting, on March 26th, House Republicans, led by the QAnon conspiracy theorist and Trump mouthpiece Marjorie Taylor Greene, Republican from Georgia, staged an anti-communist hearing entitled "Anti-American Airwaves Holding the Heads of NPR and PBS Accountable." On May 1, Trump issued an executive order regarding the CPB, ending taxpayer subsidization of biased media. The order offered several arguments for doing away with public broadcasting. Quote, "Unlike in 1967, when the CPB was established, today the media landscape is filled with abundant, diverse, and innovative news options. Government funding of news media in this environment is not only outdated and unnecessary, but corrosive to the appearance of journalistic independence," end quote. In reality, of course, while the internet has had vast consequences, the monopolization of the mainstream media industry has grown by leaps and bounds. As recently as the mid-1980s, some 50 corporations controlled the majority of U.S. media. That number is now down to six. Media analyst Ben Bagdikian proved 2 decades ago that 1,468 daily newspapers, 6,000 assorted magazines, 10,000 radio stations, 2,700 television and cable stations, and 2,600 book publishers in the U.S. were under the aegis of just 5 major multinational corporations. The May 1 White House executive order further claimed, repeating the mantra of the far right, that neither NPR nor PBS, quote, presents a fair, accurate, or unbiased portrayal of current events to taxpaying citizens, end quote. The White House and Republican Party regularly label voices of political opposition within the U.S. as radical left-wing and communist, including those of the public radio and television networks generally aligned with the pro-capitalist politics of the Democratic Party. David Bozell of the ultra-right Media Research Center celebrated the Senate's decision in an ex post. He asserted, quote, "PBS and NPR were chartered to provide objective journalism. Instead, we got drag shows for kids, gushing coverage of Democrats, and silence or smears for conservatives," end quote. One has to pull apart this comment for its various strands of right-wing fantasy and social backwardness. In fact, the general course of the NPR and PBS officialdom, as part of the Democratic Party orbit and upper-middle-class liberal milieu, has been steadily to the right over the decades. Under attack from figures like Senator Jesse Helms of North Carolina, the cultural establishment took a knife to its vital parts years ago and did its best to remove or neutralize them. Every reasonable effort has been made to fund the anodyne, innocuous, and non-threatening in television, radio, and cultural programming generally. Almost inevitably, given the catastrophic role of the corporate and financial oligarchy, with its relentless and lethal crimes against the population, a degree of criticism of American business practices and official political life has made its way onto the public airwaves, along with a measure of historical objectivity, for example, the Ken Burns documentaries. This is termed lunatic Marxist propaganda. The depth of the American bourgeoisie's crisis is so great, and its terror and anticipation of mass opposition so pronounced, that serious analysis or social reproach is now considered impermissible, a casting of aspersion on and a threat to the American free enterprise system. The response of the Democratic Party to the Senate action has been predictably pathetic. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, speaking on the Senate floor, contended that Americans relied on public broadcasting for weather alerts, adding that, quote, these cuts couldn't come at a worse time, end quote. In fact, the destruction of public broadcasting, along with every other social gain or right, means little to the Democrats or wins their overt or covert support. Far more important from their point of view is Trump's sudden surge in interest in arming and encouraging Ukraine against Russia. The defense of public access to information and culture falls to the working class and its political development in a socialist direction. You can find these articles and more at wsws.org.
The World Socialist website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.